This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. When we think of popular backyard hobbies, gardening, landscaping, maybe a fish pond come to mind. Well, there's now new interest in raising chickens and beekeeping. This hour, why more people are investing in hens and hives. We'll talk about the how-tos in just a bit, but first we get an update on how bees in this country are doing since the advent about 10 years ago of a disaster called colony collapse disorder. Joining us by phone is Dennis Van Engelsdorp, assistant professor in the Department of Entomology at the University of Maryland. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
So colony collapse disorder hit hard in the mid-2000s. Give us a brief history of what happened.
So colony collapse disorder we use to describe a phenomenon where what would happen is that colonies, large beekeeping operations particularly, would have 3,000 colonies and see 2,000 of those colonies leave within a matter of weeks. And so it was a very specific set of symptoms that was really rapid loss of those adult bees. Now, since then, we don't see colony collapse disorder very much in the field, but we're still seeing very high rates of losses. And so not all our losses are colony collapse disorder by the strict definition, but we're still seeing, on average, 30% of the colonies dying every winter and about 50% dying over the whole entire course of the year, which is astronomical because you can't imagine another agriculture system where people could afford to lose half their colonies.
So, Dennis, what would the average losses be then? What would you prefer to see?
Well, we asked that to beekeepers, and beekeepers tend to say that they think a sustainable rate of loss over the winter is 15%. So we think that that's a good target. It was about 10% historically, so 15%. So we're about double what would be normal.
So what are some of the reasons for the high rates?
Well, we think it's three causes. We were hoping to find one cause. We think it's actually three. One are these varroa mites, which are these very large, they're vampire mites that suck the blood of the bees and pass viruses. Mm. And we know that this is killing a lot of colonies. And we think it's probably leading to immune suppression and causing other trouble. The other problem is pesticides. Of course, pesticides that farmers and gardeners are applying to their plants and the bees are bringing back in pollen and nectar, but also some of the pesticides beekeepers are using to try to control varroa mite. And the other big thing is lack of nutrition. And so what we've seen with the increase of corn and soybean prices across the country is that a lot of meadows that used to be meadows, acres that used to be meadows, are being plowed under and grown in corn and soybean, meaning that the traditional grounds for bees to fatten up in the summer to get ready for the winter just aren't there anymore, and this is causing a big problem.
So let's get back to colony collapse disorder for just a second. Are you saying that that situation has been essentially resolved?
Well, I think that what's happened is that that situation was probably, the symptoms were the result of a viral infection, and that viral infection was because of a decrease in immunity. And we think that bees are still suffering decreased immunity. It's just not the same symptoms manifest. So we're still seeing high losses. It's just not all in that same characteristic that we saw with colony collapse disorder.
And to the varroa mite, so the beekeeper generally fights the varroa mite with pesticides, which might in turn harm the bees. Can you get into that a little bit?
So you're trying to kill a bug, a mite, on a bee, which is another insect. And so you can imagine that that's difficult. Now, fortunately, there are some organic options out there, some organic acids, some essential oils that work. Treating bees with a pesticide to control varroa mite goes against, the beekeeper's nature, and it seems wrong, but it's a lot like chemotherapy. You don't do it because it's good for you. It's just a lot better than the alternative. And so I think that beekeepers who aren't treating, and everyone needs to have a treatment regime in place, are losing a lot more colonies than those who don't or are treating. And so we really think it's important that all beekeepers treat their colonies for varroa, using some of these organic options if they can, because if they don't, what happens is those colonies die and the mites that are in those colonies then spread to your neighbor's colonies. Mm. And we're seeing this knockdown effect occur, particularly in the small-scale beekeepers on the East Coast.
Let's focus on pesticides for a moment a little bit more fully. A number of articles, including one in Business Insider in May, are pointing to a class of pesticide known as the neonicotinoid, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, as being a main culprit in some of these afflictions that bees are suffering. This is an insecticide that acts as a nerve poison, correct?
Well, that's right. And so this product is unique in the fact that it was introduced, and what you need to do is you just need to paint a little bit onto the seed of a plant, and then the plant sucks that pesticide in, and it's in the leaves. And it was developed in order to reduce how many times you need to spray pesticides. Now, unfortunately, small amounts of this are getting in pollen and nectar. And there's been a lot of work done on seeing, well, what those levels do to bee health. And it's clear that in laboratory settings, this has a negative effect on bee health. What isn't clear is that it's having a colony-level effect. Having said that, one of the problems is that when they're planting these seeds that are treated with neonics, it creates a dust cloud, and that dust cloud is highly toxic. And so we've seen some major bee kills on beehives that are right beside fields as they're getting plowed. And so I think it's a little bit more complicated than one pesticide. I think most people would agree with that. But what we are seeing is tremendous numbers of pesticides in the pollen bees are bringing back. And we think that these pesticides work together so that it's not just, it's not 1 plus 1 is equal 2, but 1 plus 1 is equal to 5. So it's having a very multiplying effect, a synergistic effect on the toxicity. And we're trying to understand why these low amounts of pesticides seem to be having such a pronounced effect on colony health.
And ironically, agriculture needs bees.
Well, that's right. One in every three bites of food we eat is pollinated directly or indirectly by honeybees. And so we need to have a movable pollination force if we want to produce the fruits and vegetables we do in this country.
According to an article in the Washington Post, a third of our food supply, fruits, vegetables, nuts, is pollinated by bees. And yet the current U.S. honeybee population is now less than half of what it was in 1945. So I'm not sure if you have this information on hand, but what started happening back in the earlier part of the 20th century?
Well, it's a really good question. It's something that we've spent some time trying to figure out. There seems to be a relationship between land use and bees, and of course how much urbanization there is and the number of colonies. But we really think that the major driver of this decline of honeybee colonies is economics. And so what we can show is that in years where we know that beekeepers can make money, the number of colonies in the country increases the following year. And the opposite is true. So if they're losing money, there are fewer colonies the next year. Mm. And so one of the big drivers actually is socioeconomic, is that it's the economics. And there's good news there. It means that beekeepers are very creative and can solve a lot of their problems if they can make money doing what they're doing. Our worry is, though, with 30% loss every year or 50% loss every year, beekeepers can't keep up replacing their dead colonies, and they'll go out of business. And, of course, that doesn't just affect them. It affects all the farmers who rely on them to pollinate their different crops.
What are some other pollinators? It's not just the bees.
Well, right. So honeybees are imported. They're imported from Europe, and they've been here several hundred years, but they're not native. But there are over 4,000 native species of bees in North America, and these tend not to be colony nesters. They tend to be solitary, nesting in twigs or in the ground. We also have, of course, some birds. Hummingbirds pollinate some of the particularly red-flowered plants. Moths and butterflies. But the main commercial pollinators, the ones we're using for agriculture, are honeybees.
So are these other pollinators, though, essential to agriculture?
I think so. I think there's a growing evidence that having them there with honeybees is excellent. If you have both honeybees and native bees visiting your flowers, the quality and the quantity of fruit you get is better. So it tends to be an advantage to have both types of bees present. And fortunately, native bees are something that we can encourage in our own little environments, too. They tend to be small. They don't tend to sting. And so there's lots we can do to encourage their populations, especially in the urban environment.
Are they, too, affected by pesticides or the varroa mite?
Well, they're not affected by varroa mite. Varroa mite is very specific to honeybees.
Okay.
But yes, they are affected by pesticides, and we have reason to believe that they're probably more sensitive to pesticides than honeybees are because they live on their own. So they're solitary. Honeybees live in this social unit, and so they can lose a lot of their members, and that colony can still thrive. With solitary bees, that's not the case. If you lose a female, you've lost a generation of bees.
Mm.
And so we're particularly concerned about native bee populations, and unfortunately, they're not nearly as well studied or managed.
The organic movement, of course, is growing in this country, but we're largely reliant, or agriculture is, on pesticides to help produce crops. Is there any way to turn the tide or to change the use of pesticides in order to produce a healthier number of honeybees in this country?
Oh, I absolutely think so. I think that if you look at what we're spraying and when we're spraying it, a lot of what we're doing is we're just farmers are using it as an insurance policy, because just in case things go bad. I think we have to go back to making sure we're using these products when we need them. And so we have to figure out how we know when we need them and use them judiciously. Having said that, I want to point out the fact that backyard gardeners use more pesticides per acre than any farmer does. Mm. And so there's especially, I think, home gardeners could do a lot to reduce the amount of pesticide that's in the urban environment, because they're using an awful lot of products and probably a lot of it unnecessarily.
So you've talked about what can be done. Is there a will to do it?
I think so. I think that there's a lot of people. I mean, the president just had a memorandum trying to investigate and try to curb some of these losses. I think there's a lot of attention being drawn to this, and I think that we have to do something. If we want to produce apples and nuts in this country, we need a movable pollination force. It's going to be slow work, I think, and it's going to have multiple angles. We have to increase how much area there is for bees to forage on. We have to reduce pesticides. We have to come up with better control methods for some of the problems with bees, like varroa mite. So it's a multi-pronged problem, so it has to have a multi-pronged solution. But I'm hopeful. I do think that we can make strides.
And as you just mentioned, President Obama has signed a memorandum establishing the first ever federal pollinator strategy. Can you get into that a little bit more? What does the president want to do specifically?
Well, I think he's formed a task force to look for creative ideas on how to help solve some of the bee problems. So looking at land management, can we convert some of, especially our not well-producing soil, not our marginal lands, can we make that into pollinator habitat? Can we re-look at how we're applying pesticides and their need, especially on federal grounds? When there is a forest fire, can we seed it with pollinator plants? And so I think it's really trying to take a comprehensive look at those little ways we can help bees, and by doing a whole bunch of small little things, I think we can have a big impact.
So, Dennis,
the size of go ahead.
Oh no, I was going to say, because we're coming up on a break. I just wanted to if you could, as we wrap up this segment, to just characterize the health of honeybees in this country in one sentence, if you would.
I think that the honeybee,
are we in a crisis mode, or is it on the rebound? In a word or two.
No, I would say that we are maintaining. We are still losing half of the colonies in the country every year, and that's too many.
Okay.
And so we need to figure out solutions to that problem before the commercial beekeepers go bankrupt.
Okay, Dennis Van Engelsdorp, assistant professor in the Department of Entomology at the University of Maryland. Thanks so much. We talk about raising chickens and keeping bees ahead on Radio Times. Stay with us.
How should you react when a line of evergreens gets too big for its needles? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll help a listener safely reduce the size of his bad view blocking hemlocks. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. and noon, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Stephen Quinn. Author John Ronson joins me to talk about Frank, a new movie about a rising band and its oddball lead singer, inspired by John's own new wave outfit, the Frank Sidebottom Band. That's coming up on Cue the Summer from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The latest healthcare developments.
How what happens in Washington affects you.
How world events affect us all.
The news continues throughout your day. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are your co-hosts for Here and Now. Breaking news, thoughtful analysis, surprising interviews in the middle of your day.
With voices from all across the country, so you won't miss a thing.
That's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Have you ever considered raising chickens or keeping bees? These hobbies are becoming increasingly popular in suburban and urban areas. And here this hour to offer insight into the how-tos and the pros and cons that chicken coop needs to be cleaned are Brian Moyer, Program Assistant for the Penn State Extension. He teaches classes on raising chickens. Hello, Brian.
Hello.
And Beatrice Tissot owns Buzzing Acres Farm and Tissot Apiaries with her husband Jean-Claude in Hunterdon County, New Jersey. She joins us by phone. Hi, Beatrice.
Good morning.
And as always, we invite you to join the conversation if you're listening to Radio Times. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I've lived in my New Jersey neighborhood for over 20 years, and in the last five, two families have adopted chickens, and one has kept a hive. So, Brian Moyer, first to you, simple question, why the interest in chickens?
I think it goes back to, the growing popularity of the local food movement, and people becoming more interested in where their food comes from, and then more interested in having that connection, of trust in their food. And keeping chickens is not very difficult to do. It's one of the easier pieces of livestock to raise, and traditionally it was always given to the children to take care of in farming because they are not that difficult to keep. I also see it in a number of, especially with some younger families, and so it becomes an educational component for children about where their food comes from. Chickens are interesting to look at. You can get them to any kind of color or size you can think of. They're kind of fun to watch.
Are they friendly?
Hens are friendly.
Okay.
Roosters are not friendly generally. And plus, in a neighborhood like yours, I'm sure there might even be ordinances on not being able to have roosters because you can imagine why it crowing at 3 in the morning or something.
And they do that every day religiously early in the morning?
Well, that's part of their job of protecting the flock.
Okay. Yeah, there are no roosters in my neighborhood.
Yeah, it's probably.
So I'm guessing, though, eggs right out of the nest are that much better than something you might buy at the market?
Yeah, anything that fresh, right? Something right out of your garden, a tomato freshly picked, egg straight from a chicken. I mean, as soon as you crack that egg into the pan, you see a difference of mm-hmm. what that egg looks like, maybe even what that egg tastes like, depending on how you raise those chickens.
What do you feed them?
So if you're starting out, the most popular thing is, of course, in the spring, and out where I live in Berks County, of course, all the feed stores and stuff have what they call the chick days. And it's a period of time people place orders and you can get your day-old chicks that come from the hatchery. And then so basically there's a special starter rations that can be fed. Chickens are omnivores, meaning that they, like we are omnivores. We eat a multi-variety of fruits, vegetables, meats, what have you. And chickens are the same way. Hence, that's what they like to have. So besides the feed, they also have, if they have access to outdoors, they get some, they'll eat some fresh grass, they'll scratch around for bugs.
Take care of the tick population?
Help take care of ticks.
All right. It's a plus.
The thing to remember is that it's difficult. Everything likes chicken. We like chicken. We like eggs. And everything, unless it's an herbivore or vegetarian, likes chicken. So, if you're doing this from a family setting standpoint, be aware that, there are hawks, there are owls, there are foxes, and maybe in your neighborhood it could even be stray cats or dogs.
Oh, sure.
Would do a lot of damage as much as any other animal from the wild.
All right. Well, we'll get into that a little bit more fully as we move along in the show. I'd like to bring Beatrice Tissot mm-hmm. into the conversation because we're talking about chickens and bees.
Right.
Beatrice, we addressed this earlier in the show that there's been an increasing interest from hobbyists in beekeeping since colony collapse disorder. But the key here is they are stinging insects. So who's keeping bees?
A lot of different people. But I have to say that it is also part of the beekeeper's job, if I may say so, quote unquote, to educate people on bees. And what you just mentioned, the fact that they sting is something we are, you know, you teach people how to work the bees, you know, the best way in order not to be stung. But, you know, all kinds of people in New Jersey are keeping bees. And just like you mentioned, there is a huge interest now to help Mother Nature with bees. Everybody is very conscious that we are losing bees. And a lot of people want to integrate a hive, you know, in their backyard as, you know, it's part of the landscaping, but it's also part of helping. It's, they want to do their share and help and raise bees. And, you know, everybody's happy. They have beautiful gardens. Their neighbors are happy because they have beautiful flowers. So, you know, everybody's happy about, you know, that new phenomenon of raising bees.
So Brian Moyer had mentioned that chickens are relatively easy to raise. How about bees? Is it an easy hobby?
I would say it's not very complicated. You know, if it's a hobby, you have one or two hives, and we all, you know, we always advise people to have two hives so you can compare, you know, to see how they are doing compared to each other. You know, it's you have a lot of people ready to help you when you start. You know, you have a lot of local beekeepers association that are great to help you. You have mentors. It's a family and friend hobby, if I may say so. So, you know, that's basically what people are doing and helping each other in that area.
What do you need to do every day to take care of a hive?
You don't necessarily look at your hive every day. You do it periodically on a regular basis. You want to make sure that you know, your bees have enough space in their beehive, because if they don't have enough space, they would swarm, and that's a huge issue. You would lose half of your colony. So the beekeeper's job is to make sure they have enough space. The beekeeper's job also, when the season starts and the season ends, is also to make sure they have enough honey in the hive to survive the winter. So that's another thing. And just like, you know, we talked about earlier, you also need to make sure that you don't have disease in your hive that could be, you know, that could affect other beehives around. And if you do, you need to make sure that you address those issues and those varroa mites we talked about. But it's not an everyday job.
Beatrice, as I'm sure you know, because you're in New Jersey, regulations regarding bees vary from town to town. And some mm-hmm. towns outright say, no, you cannot have backyard hives for the obvious reasons. How far do bees travel, and how can you be a good neighbor if you have a beehive in your neighborhood?
I think bees travel from on a radius of 3 miles to 3.5 miles. So they travel, you know, kind of, they do a lot of miles when you think about it. It's true that a lot of municipalities are prohibiting beekeeping, but it's improving a lot. You know, just like we talked about, we learn now how we need the bees and how useful they are. So I think that apart from the fact, you know, that when you are in a very suburban area, that could be an issue. A lot of municipalities and counties are now, you know, improving the authorizations and allowing people to have bees. I think the best way is also if you're allowed and you want to put a hive in your backyard, is just also to educate your neighbors. You know, tell them that they don't have to be scared, that, you know, they will benefit from those bees. And it's all a question of education. I think that's a big part of a beekeeper's job.
And I should mention that in New Jersey, a package of 6 bills is expected to be taken up by the New Jersey Senate next month. It's already passed the Assembly, and that would regulate statewide keeping bees.
Yes.
So, but again, if somebody is next door and they have to use an EpiPen because they're allergic, how do you resolve that with your neighbor?
Well, I think that what I always tell people is, first, you need to, before you start everything, you just, you know, sometimes it's wiser to go and talk to your neighbors about it and make sure that, you know, they make sure that, just like you mentioned, nobody is highly allergic to bees. But there is also a false idea going on, is that there is a big difference of between being allergic, meaning that, you know, if you're stung by a bee, your throat is going to close and you won't be able to breathe, and a normal reaction to a bee sting. So that's also something that we always, you know, educate people about this. There is a big, big difference between the two, you know, the two phenomenons. However, you know, if your neighbor is not happy with you, so if you don't have the right to farm, then, you know, it's going to be an issue for the beekeeper. You're right.
And Brian Moyer, you'd like to jump in here?
Just from the Pennsylvania side, of course, every municipality is going to have its own ordinances regarding bees or chickens or any kind of bees are livestock from an agricultural standpoint. So you would check with, so there isn't any statewide one for Pennsylvania, so people should check with their local zoning to see what they're able to do on their property.
Sure, thanks for that. What does it take to be a good neighbor if you're going to raise chickens? Do they smell? Are they noisy? We talked about that a little bit with the roosters, but how about the hens?
So it's the same as Beatrice was saying about, you know, are our neighbors going to be thrilled that we're going to have this hobby? If they are okay with it, still be a matter of being respectful to what's going on in your neighbor's property. You know, how close to the property line are you going to keep that coop? Is it going to be a nice coop, or is it going to be something that you've slapped together? And also, how are you? Are they going to move around the yard? How are you going to handle the manure?
But how often do you need to clean it?
As often as needs to be. It could be daily. It could be, depending on how many chickens to how much space. And it is compostable. It is wonderful stuff if you have a garden to compost it. Their chickens are going to scratch. They're going to scratch up a ground, and they can devastate that ground pretty quickly if you're going to keep them in one spot. It's going to wind up to be just bare dirt. Because the chicken manure is actually very, it's full of nitrogen and phosphorus, which is great stuff in to compost.
But right on the grass.
Not necessarily right on the grass. It's going to burn it out.
So do you find that when you're teaching these classes that people come in and they're kind of starry-eyed and they've got their kids and they want to raise chickens because it just looks really neat? Do they understand, or do they know this stuff coming in to an extent?
Some do. I'd say a lot of them have done a fair amount of research on it, and I'd say there is, you know, there people can get as passionate about their birds as beekeepers do about keeping bees, and there is, same as with bees, there's all kinds of help. You know, we have 4-H clubs, through every county in Pennsylvania that through the Extension Service that kids can join. Poultry clubs are generally extremely active anymore, and so are the formed bee clubs now in 4-H that they can hardly keep up with the demand of kids who want to do that as well.
We are talking about raising chickens or keeping bees. Brian Moyer is program assistant for the Penn State Extension. He teaches classes on raising chickens. And Beatrice Tassot owns Buzzing Acres Farm with her husband Jean-Claude in Hunterdon County, New Jersey. Telephone number is 888-477-9499. We've got some calls coming in. John in Haverford, Pennsylvania, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much. This is a great show.
Sure. Thanks.
My question was about beekeeping. We hear so much about keeping bees these days, and it's all based in very much good intentions and doing well for the environment. And it makes me think of the fact that the bee that's kept is a foreign bee. And is there a way to raise bees that are native species bees?
That's a great question.
Has that ever been done?
Thanks, John, for the call.
I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Beatrice?
That's a very good question, actually. We work on our apiaries. We work, you know, with beekeepers, and we are getting bees from, the southern states, Georgia, and so on and so forth. And there are plenty of different species of bees. If you have your bees in your yard and they will breed and so on and so forth, they will be there in the beehives and be on your property from the area you're from. But I'm not really sure. Maybe this gentleman who talked about, you know, colony collapse disorder would be much better, give a much better answer than I just did.
Thanks. Yeah,
As he referenced, the, you know, from the local pollinator standpoint, they're generally more solitary. They're not going to be in colonies like the honeybees are. There are bumblebees, which are actually really good pollinators, that they just don't make honey. I mean, that's the one benefit, right, we get from honeybees.
What's the point?
So what is usually encouraged is trying to create habitat areas for those our native pollinators, so we can have that variety of pollination that he had referred to. So we get, you know, more food and better quality food.
Okay, let's get back to the phones. Bernie is standing by in East Kensington. Hello, Bernie.
Hi. I raise Italian honeybees in my backyard in East Kensington, and my next-door neighbors have three chickens. By the way, you had a guest on earlier who said that chickens are omnivores. Chickens love to eat bees.
It's another thing on the menu.
Yeah. Mine maybe, and probably not many. But I call to relate an amusing anecdote I've had about living with neighbors with row home backyards, and when you raise honeybees. I have very nice next-door neighbors on the other side of me who have two kids. One was a 10-year-old girl, and the other was a teenage boy. And they were very afraid of honeybees, and I was educating them about the honeybees, showing them the hive and in under safe conditions, like blowing smoke at the honeybees, which calms them down. And they were very curious, and they enjoyed learning. I gave them some honey to eat, and they really liked that. Well, I was working with the honeybees one day, and one of them got angry, which happens sometimes, and it flew, and it landed right on the face of this next-door neighbor girl. I said, Don't hit him, don't hit him. But she instinctively swatted the honeybee on her face, and it stung her right above the eye. I felt terrible, especially since I had taught her not to be terribly afraid of them. And it caused a huge problem with me and the father, as you can imagine. I was able to straighten it all out, but it was, I mean, I felt horrible. She's fine. And I made sure before I even started raising honeybees that none of them were allergic. But in any case, it can be a challenge.
Yeah.
Both the kids are still—they're not afraid of the bees anymore, but they learn to respect them a bit more, and not to swat them. That's the thing. If you swat a honeybee, if you swat a bee on you,
it's going to react.
But if you just brush it off, it'll be fine.
Bernie, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times, and Beatrice, I'm sure you hear this all the time.
Yes, we do.
Well, what is the proper reaction? You don't swat at them. What do you do? And part two of that is, how do you handle the stings? I'm sure you've had your fair share.
Yeah, we do. We are stung often, and like, you know, everybody says, we do not get used to it, and it still hurts. Mm-hmm. But I would say, you know, I had the same exact issue with one of our customers who came to visit the farm not too long ago, and she, you know, a bee got very close to her, and she did exactly, you know, what this gentleman just described, and she panicked. So I think that's the human reaction is to panic. It's very hard to stay still and not to, you know, show any movement and so on and so forth. But, you know, once you learn that, you know, you don't swat the bees and she will probably go away. Well, if you are stung, you know, the thing to do right away is to remove the stinger if it's still there. And, you know, the reaction will be that, you know, you're going to be swollen for a few days, but that's one more time.
All right.
That's not being allergic.
Beatrice, we've got a break coming up. Beatrice Tissot, co-owner of Buzzing Acres Farm. Brian Moyer is program assistant for the Penn State Extension. More on bees and chickens straight ahead on Radio Times. Stay with us.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival presents Old Crow Medicine Show, Jason Isbell, Janice Ian, Loudon Wainwright III, Natalie McMaster, Tempest, The Lone Bellow, Tommy Emmanuel, Sarah Jaroche, and many more. For a weekend of concerts, crafts, kids' activities, and camping, it's the Philadelphia Folk Festival, August 14th through the 17th on the Old Pool Farm in Upper Salford. For tickets and festival information, 800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Lethem. His latest novel, Dissident Gardens, follows three generations of a radical leftist family, somewhat like his own. He grew up in a quasi-commune where at meetings,
adults would air out their grievances to 8-year-old children as if we were all equally entitled to suffer one another's complaints. And I kind of loved it.
Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Good go tell it on the mountain. In the name of humanity, come to our rescue. Come to our rescue. An appeal from innocent civilians trapped on a mountain in Iraq and caught in a religious war. And a community in Lincoln, Nebraska reaches out from the other side of the world. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Some do it for the fresh eggs, some for the honey, others perhaps for the thrill of working with live stinging insects. We're talking about bees, of course, and chickens, and why people take up beekeeping and raising chickens as hobbies. How to get started? Our guests are Beatrice Tissot, co-owner of Buzzing Acres Farm and Tissot Apiaries in Hunterdon County, New Jersey, and Brian Moyer is program assistant for the Penn State Extension. And Brian, we were talking a little bit during the break about the responsibility of raising chickens. You said it's easy, but you have to take care of them, and there's stuff to do every day. Let's start with the coop. Chicken coop can be as easy as throwing up a tent, or I have to laugh. You know, chickens have arrived when Neiman Marcus comes up with a coop that costs $100,000 and looks like Versailles.
Yeah, right.
But you know, most everybody who's starting it can be a lot simpler.
Does it come with a butler? You know,
you'll wish if you have to clean the coop every day.
Right.
But what does it take? First of all, describe the coop, an average coop, and how much does it cost?
Well, coops can range from anywhere, and tells me the popularity of backyard chickens is the fact that I know more and more veterinarians that take care of our dogs and cats now are dealing with chickens and know how to deal with chickens, because before, nobody did. You did not have a veterinarian come look at your sick chickens. You know, it was just from an economic standpoint. And if you think about what eggs cost in the store and raising them on a large commercial scale, I would get those calls when I was farming full time. Someone was keeping my chicken. Something was wrong, and I said, "What would you do?" And I said, "Well, that chicken is not around anymore." You know.
Okay.
But that's not the point here. The point here is it's a project. It's someone's pet. All these chickens probably have names.
Sure.
And they want to give that chicken the best possible life they can. So the coops from anywhere from every spring you can see, like if you think of the large retailers like Tractor Supply and some of them like that, or out where I am, any feed store, I mean, there are coops, Amish design coops. The guy down the road might make some coops. When I went from doing commercial chickens to now having my own backyard flock, I was able to find, a local Mennonite farmer that was selling them on the side. So I get a very nice coop for very reasonably priced. Ideally, if you're getting a coop, maybe that's where you're going to put those chicks, right, from day one. And so, but now the coop is now also a brooder, because you're going to need to raise them from chicks to adolescence, and that's going to take about 20 weeks.
Okay. So, let me also, too, give the telephone numbers out. It's 888-477-9499 if you have any questions about chickens or bees. Radio Times at WHYY.org is our email, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times.
But if I could, I'd direct folks to extension.psu.edu/poultry.
For more information?
Yeah, there's a number of handouts and techniques to talk about proper brooding techniques for chickens.
Okay. And you touched on this a little bit ago, too, but, many chickens in the backyard are pets. They lay for, a couple of years?
Right.
And then what?
And then what? Right, exactly. That's the question. What are we going to do now? And if it's because some of us farmers would get those calls as well, too, say, well, my chickens are done laying. Do you want them? Thinking that I'm just going to have them live their life out on the farm. Well, that becomes an economic responsibility for me.
Sure.
Now I have a chicken that's also not producing a product that I would normally sell. So, no, chickens can't go to somebody else's farm. And there's also biosecurity reasons for that, too.
How long do they normally live?
Well, it depends on the breed. So some of your more heritage breeds can live quite a few years. Maybe more commercial breeds, maybe not so quite as long, but they can live for many years. So the question, how are we going to think about what the total lifespan of this chicken from chick until she's not around anymore?
Beatrice Tissot, what is it like to set up a hive? Difficult or fairly simple?
No, it's fairly simple. What we always recommend to, you know, our potential beekeepers is beekeeping is not complicated. However, there are a few basic things you need to learn before you get started. So we always tell to, you know, to our customers, you know, if they want to have a beehive for the next spring, winter is perfect to, you know, read about it and also buy your wood. You know, buy you the wood and you would put your hive together. You assemble. This is a great family project. And then, you know, attend, we would suggest to attend a short course. You know, Rutgers University or any local beekeepers association have very good short course that you should attend before, you know, before getting, you know, diving in beekeeping. Then you order your bees, you know, at the very beginning of the year, around January, you order your bees, and then when the bees are coming, at the end of March, the beginning of April, you're all set. Your beehive is all set, your bees are coming, you learn how to install a package of bees in your hive, and you're all set to go. But I think it's very important for people to learn and be educated before diving in beekeeping.
How is the hive set up? You've got the queen, and take it from there, if you would.
So yes, when you start a beehive, you order, you know, most of people order a package of bees, and it's a 3-pound package of bees that comes, you know, from the southern states. In there, you have one queen, and you have worker bees, and generally a few drones. That's how you start. So when your package of bees arrive, you know, you will have this queen, that queen cage that you will first put in your hive before shaking all the bees, you know, on top. And the queen bee is in this little cage, and you have a cork, you know, regular cork on one side and a candy cork on the other side, and she'll, the queen is going to start eating the candy from the inside. Mm-hmm. The bees that you're going to shake, you know, on top of this are going to start eating the candy from the outside, and hopefully after 3 days everybody is going to meet and be happy and, you know, and live forever after so happily together. But that's how you start. It's not very complicated, but you one more time, you need to learn and you need to attend a short course before.
Fascinating. And Beatrice, just one more quick question before we get back to chickens. What are the bees like when they're in that container? Are they sluggish? Do you need to...
No, they are... They're not too happy. You have to remember that they traveled from Georgia. So they are, you know, they are, usually what is happening is that we collect those bees coming from Georgia at night. So at night they are, you know, a lot more, quiet, if I may say so, and not so agitated. And then when we deliver those bees to our customers, we ask them to come very quickly because they need to be transferred to a beehive as soon as possible. You know, it's just being in that package for 2 days, and they need space, and they need to be able to, you know, be able to, you know, be in a bigger space very quickly.
And part of the equipment you need is a suit of some sort and a mask. Can you describe that, please?
A veil and a suit, and you know, you need you would need a hive tool. Very, very simple things, and a smoker. But this has been, you know, those are being the basic tools for centuries, and they are not, you know, they are still the same.
Okay, we've got some calls, so let's get to them. Rich, welcome to Radio Times. You used to have some chickens in South Philadelphia?
Yeah. We had chickens, and we kept them on our roof. And then, you know, we had them for eggs, and then when we moved, we didn't have roof access at our new place. So, you know, part of the responsibility of owning them was knowing that this was a possibility. So we had to slaughter them and eat them. Mm. And I think that people have to, you know, consider that when getting them.
So they weren't pets, I guess.
Well, I mean, we didn't name them. You know, we thought of them as livestock.
Right. So, yeah, that's a... And I commit for thinking that whole process through. Because that is the key. That is the responsibility, I would say. You know, we've actually had offers since my wife works in suburban area down here, and some people think, oh, for their grandchild, they were going to get, for Easter, they're going to get a chick.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and she said, well, what are you going to do with that chick? She said, well, we're going to give it to you to take back to your farm. When that, this is not how this works. It's not necessarily the best interest of that chicken to do that. So.
Sure. And so when you, and thank you for the call to Radio Times, Rich. So if it comes time to make the decision to slaughter the chicken, what do you do? I know my grandmother told stories of like, they did it themselves in the backyard. Most people don't do that, though, I'm guessing. Or some do.
Quite a few do. There are processes you can take them to who will do it for you. And also keep in mind that that chicken is not the same kind of chicken you buy in the store. They're two different breeds. Meat chickens are very different from laying chickens. And so it is... still could be a delicious chicken, but it's going to be and your grandmother might have told you too that that cooked all day. It's right. A slow cook, and it's going to be a very different thing than we're used to buying in the store. But the to that point of one thing I would also recommend, what a lot of people like to do is they think to keep a really good eye on those chicks, and they're very worried about the safety of those chicks. They'll brood them in the house. And after about a week, you'll be very sorry you did that, because they chickens create a lot of dust.
Really?
Yeah. And so if you have any kind of respiratory issues, it could be really irritating. So unless you – maybe in a garage?
What kind of dust?
Well, they
just – from the excrement?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Back to the phones we go. Susan, you're live on Radio Times. How are you, Susan? Susan, you there
Hi,
with
how
us?
Are you?
Hi, we're
yes,
fine.
Sorry,
thank you.
I had to take my phone off speakerphone. We live on a little hobby farm. We have 20 chickens, 4 sheep, and a rogue rooster that showed up. And my husband actually is allergic to bees. He needs an EpiPen.
Mm-hmm.
But and we were interested in doing bees. So I'm just wondering, is it a given if you have a hive that you're like, you know, people that live on our property that they're going to get stung, or is it more the person who's actually tending to the hives?
Good question. Thanks for the call. Beatrice?
I would say both. You know, you as a beekeeper, you will get stung. No question about it, even if you're the most careful beekeeper. So, and I know a lot of beekeepers who are totally allergic to bees and work with an EpiPen, you know, with them all the time. But, you know, as I explained a few minutes earlier, you can, you know, people visiting or anybody around can be stung if they, you know, bees will only sting if they feel threatened. So, if by any chance you are in the, you know, in the pattern, you will be stung. So it's just, I think it's also, you need to be careful. You need to let people know what to do and what not to do, and to avoid, you know, to avoid being stung. But, you know, this will happen. I mean, it's no secret.
I've always been interested in how these creatures survive the winter when you're taking care of them. Beatrice, let's start with you first. What do you do to keep the hive going through the winter?
Well, as I explained a little bit earlier, we make sure they have, you know, enough honey. You know, so if you see a beehive, you have two deep boxes where they live, and when they, and, you know, the queen is laying eggs and so on and so forth. We do not touch those two boxes. We need to make sure they have enough for the winter. Some beekeepers are also, you know, putting some tarp paper around the hive. Something that I always mention also is that beekeepers like very tough winters. When you have snow, the snow is insulating the beehive. The bees are not getting out. They stay inside, so they eat very slowly the honey they stored. If there is a mild winter, they'll get out. They'll fly and don't see any flowers. In order to fly, you need energy, so they will eat the honey they piled, you know, together a lot quicker, mm-hmm. and might starve. So we make sure that they have enough to survive the winter, and then, you know, if it's when it's winter, it's cold, you cannot open the hive, so that's where, you know, you have to be patient until the first nice days of spring to see what happens.
And Brian Moyer, I'm just curious, I see those chickens in my neighbor's backyard running around in January, and I'm thinking, is there a heat lamp back there in the coop, or do they not need it?
They don't need it. They really don't. I mean, I put a heat lamp in the coop for my own comfort. and that means that I don't like dealing with frozen water all the time. Which is the
biggest.
You have
to go out, and then that's something you have to do. If you don't have a heat lamp, you've got to make sure the water's running for them.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, because they need water. They need the water. If they're not drinking water, then they're not eating, and also then they're not laying eggs, and also water temperature is critical to their egg laying. And you can think about this past winter, you know, how what a challenge this past winter was. And I had no problem with my chickens, and also other people I checked in with didn't really have a problem with them. The worst thing you would see, and I think here again, as Beatrice was saying, snow is actually a saver for them. Mm-hmm. But if it's a cold, not snowy winter, they can get frostbite on their combs.
Do they huddle together then in the back of the coop to stay
no.
warm?
No, if they do that, you have a draft. Huh. So you still need ventilation. You don't want that coop sealed up tight like our house, mm-hmm. because then they're going to have health problems. They do need ventilation, but a draft will make them sick.
All right. We've been talking about raising chickens, keeping bees, and Beatrice, before we wrap up, we've been talking about some of the negatives. What are the joys of raising bees? You get the honey. You get some great honey.
Yes, exactly. There is no better feeling than harvesting your first honey and then every year harvesting your honey. It's a lot of work, but it's great. And it's your own, and it's that's what people love about all this. You know, there's a great feeling about this. And of course, the taste is so much different from the honey you can buy in a supermarket. Mm. So, and if you have hives in different places, the honey will taste different. So it's a great pleasure when harvesting time comes.
And Brian Moyer, some of the benefits of raising chickens, obviously you've got the eggs. And for kids, do they make good pets if you're prepared to keep them long term?
I'm not sure so much a pet. I mean, so they're not going to develop an affection for you like a cat or a dog, right? Mm-hmm. But it is, and I think it's also that responsibility, because this is something that has to be tended to every single day. Eggs, she will lay an egg most days of the year.
All right, that's it. Some information on raising chickens and bees, some new and popular hobbies. Our thanks to Brian Moyer, Program Assistant for the Penn State Extension. We appreciate it, Brian.
Thank you for asking me.
And Beatrice Tissot is co-owner of Buzzing Acres Farm and Tissot Apiaries. Thank you very much, Beatrice.
Thank you very much.
The engineer for today's show is Kevin Griffin. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. And our supervising engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, filling in for Marty Moscoane. Thanks so much for joining us.